D-Mace, Vingen, and Donick, 102.5 The Game. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingen here with you. Let's go to our phone line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, and bring in our friend Trevor Maddich, who is brought to you by Houston Clinic Orthopedics, when experience matters. So, Trevor, we were just talking about what the Titans should do at number four. ESPN's Jason Reed suggested that the Titans follow the Carolina Panthers plan from last season when they drafted Tet McMillan at number eight overall for Bryce Young. So let's assume for a moment that the Titans do that. If the Titans pass on a pass rusher at number four, are there pass rushers who project to be available at the top of the second round who can make an impact?
Yeah, you know, I think there would be. The thing is, this is a deep draft in wide receivers and offensive tackles, and by the way, edge rushers. The difference is, though, you've got good edge rushers that are different from elite edge rushers. And it's those elite guys that can take over a game by themselves that you really want to have. A guy like Ken Hendrickson of Cincinnati, you know, that kind of a guy. And I don't think in the second round you can be assured of getting one of those guys. I think you can get a good rotational edge rusher that you can put in there opposite Jeff Simmons and have him give you 100% effort like a hockey line rotating in. You could start to do that. But after the first round, I think you're really the top half of the first round. You're probably going to have a diminished ability to take over a game with one edge rusher. Now, having said that, if Akeem Mesidor, who played opposite Reuben Bain at Miami, if he's available in the second round, I think you've got a chance of having a guy that can, if not take over a game, certainly be very impactful. Mesidor has a lot of the same qualities as Reuben Bain in terms of his toolbox of moves that he can throw on you. He's not a one-trick pony. He have a lot of different primary moves, a lot of different counters off of those moves, and it creates nightmares for offensive linemen trying to block him. But he can move from left to right on the end. He can move inside in passing situations over the guards, even over the center. And the reason he might drop is that he's a little bit older. I think he's like 25. You know, he'll be 25 next season. So a guy like that you could target as an edge rusher in the second round. But if you're thinking you'll just have a pretty good player instead of an elite game wrecker, you're better off taking that edge rusher with the fourth pick.
Trevor, I'm stealing Willie's thunder here, but we were just discussing Carnell Tate, and Willie brought up the Jeremiah Smith factor. So how much of Carnell Tate's success at Ohio State this past season was based on Smith also having the attention of opposing defenders?
That was part of it. Because if you were going to roll coverage to one guy, it was always going to be Smith, and he caught the ball anyway. Tate is a different player than Smith. Smith was a physical beast. I mean, he could play linebacker, I think, with a couple extra biscuits at pregame meal. Whereas Carnell Tate is not that kind of a guy. He's got more of a slight frame. He's got kind of a long waist. He is an elite route runner. And that's where I think he has a chance to be an impact player for the Titans, in that he can get open in a lot of different ways other than just be faster or stronger or bigger than anyone. He can get open because he knows how to get open with the techniques, with the tools of a great wide receiver. But at the same time, I think that had Jeremiah Smith not been there, I think he would have seen a higher volume go towards Tate. I think you would have seen him be even more highly regarded than he is. And while I think he had advantages because coverages were rotated towards Tate, I don't think it takes anything away from his ability overall to be an outstanding impact receiver.
Now, Trevor, can you see the Titans, because can you see them doing this? Because everyone's looking for them or wanting them to get an edge rusher. And I understand why, because they didn't have that guy this season. But do you think now adding Robert Saleh and what he's been known for as far as his edge guys, or his guys getting to the pass rusher, I mean under passer, do you look at a guy like Femi that they may look at him as being there, okay, instead of drafting a guy number, you know, in the first round at that position, Saleh can work with Femi and developing him into the player that the Titans hoped he would be and still can be.
You know what, Derek? I think Femi would be one of those rotational guys. Mm-hmm. At best, I don't see him developing into an elite pass rusher. I think he's got a good, quick first step, but I think he's a little stiff, and I don't think right now he has the repertoire of pass rush moves. I mean, his last year at UCLA was really his first year as an edge rusher. He was an off-ball linebacker other than that, and he's shown a lot of athletic skill to be able to go from off-ball linebacker to edge rusher, and now probably put his hand in the ground to be a 4-3 defensive end. You know, he's shown a lot of raw capability, but to rush the passer in the NFL, you can't just be quick. You can't just be strong. You have to be savvy. You have to have experience. You have to have anticipation. And these are all things that Femi has not had a chance to demonstrate that he can get onto the field just yet because he's moved around in different positions. So I would not count on him as being that guy. I would hope that he could develop into one of those complementary pieces that can come in and still give you good effort pass rushes as he develops his skills. But I think it would be a mistake to say, let's not draft an edge rusher because we think we can develop Femi. Make him prove it first.
We'll talk with Trevor Maddich. Trevor, obviously the big thing is the jersey change, the rebrand of the Tennessee Titans, which looks more to me like the Houston Oilers. But what are your thoughts? I will tell you my thoughts after you're done, but what are your thoughts on this?
You know what, Derek? My thought is that from a standpoint of the fans, I know players that played in those uniforms and those colors, it matters a lot, mm-hmm. a lot more than fans. I think fans have a different view of it. But from a fan standpoint, they will have an emotional connection to whatever uniforms the Titans are wearing when the Titans start making Super Bowl runs and even win a Super Bowl, and that's about it. I mean, when you look at the Patriots, for example, their original uniforms had the Patriot guy on the helmet as a center, and he had the ball. He was about to snap the ball, and he had a scowl on his face, and they had three lines, three stripes on the helmet, and three stripes on each shoulder. It was the most fearsome-looking uniform coming right at you of any in the NFL. And then they changed to what we have now. And, I mean, bless their hearts, but I think the current Patriot guy looks like Elvis goes to space camp. You know, that, I just don't see that as being a fierce kind of a – but then Tom Brady went and won six Super Bowls with that logo. So now it is fearsome. Now it is great, but you had to do that in order to get it done. I mean, look at Washington, right? You know, they were the Redskins until that didn't work, and then they were the Washington football team, and now they're the Commander. They always kept the burgundy and gold because the fans connected to that. But the Commanders, nobody's excited about the name Commanders, and they won't be until they get to the Super Bowl with the name Commanders. Then the word name Commanders will be awesome. And we look at colors. I just want to throw this out there. The Eagles, you know, I played for Washington, so you know what I think about the Eagles. but what on an eagle is green? Seriously. If the eagle isn't nauseous, what on him is green? The Eagles' colors should be gold, black, and white. That would be fantastic. But then they went and won the Super Bowl in that awful green color. So now they got to keep it because there's an emotional connection. And that brings us back to the Titans. I think that from a fan standpoint, you know, I think that they'll like one thing or the other. But I think the emotional connection will be with whatever they're wearing whenever they get back to the Super Bowl.
And that is my issue right there. And I hand it off to Willie, is that when this team unveiled those two-tone blue, that was a Nashville State of Tennessee color. That was their team. That team went to the Super Bowl. That was some of their greatest years were in that jersey. So I'm not discounting the blue that they have, or the light blue, the Tennessee blue, but to go away from potentially the navy blue, which we went to the Super Bowl in, I think that part I have, I'm sort of, you know, a little bit upset about. That you go completely away from the Bruin. Now, more or less, you look like the Houston Oilers.
Yeah.
And the Houston Oilers didn't, last I checked, when they made it to the NFL, when they merged, they didn't make it to a Super Bowl. But I'm not discounting the color.
And even had the Cleveland Browns, by the way, as the Cleveland Browns. But when they're wearing their brown jerseys and their orange helmets and they come out of the tunnel, it looks like you're being attacked by a pumpkin patch. It's like, what?
I like their colors, man.
But it's iconic, though. It's
exactly. It's iconic. Absolutely.
Because they've stuck with it.
You're right. You're right about that. I got to ask you this, though, Derek, just as devil's advocate, tell me the difference between Tennessee blue and Carolina blue.
I don't know.
Yeah, or Columbia blue.
It's Carolina blue. I don't know. Yeah. Trevor, I'm trying to figure that out myself.
Carolina blue is gross, by the way.
Yeah, in the NFL, the team that wins the Super Bowl first between the Panthers and the Titans gets to claim it. That's it.
Exactly. There you go.
Just call it something else.
Fair. Trevor Maddich is with us. So Trevor, here's a philosophical question, and maybe you can apply it to this draft, because I'm sure different years you might have a different answer. But drafting the edge rusher in this group and then the receiver early in the second round as opposed to vice versa, which one do you think you come out ahead with? Because I've heard the argument made both ways.
Yeah, Willie, I think you come out ahead assuming similar grade. If you've got a receiver and an edge rusher, your top receiver, your top edge rusher, and one's higher than the other, clearly you take the one that's higher. Just because you want to get as much playmaking talent when you're drafting at number four as you possibly can. You do not want to draft for need, right? You want to draft for, but that's part of the deal when you're in the top five. You need to have a guy that is a game changer, that kind of a guy when you're that high. You don't want a rotational piece, a complementary piece when you're drafting that high. You don't want a quality starter at number four. You want an all-pro caliber performer when you're drafting that high. And I think it's easier to find wide receivers than it is to find game-wrecking edge rushers. So if you've got an edge rusher and a receiver that are similar, I think I would go with the edge rusher. And I think part of that, too, guys, we've talked about this before, but I think we have a recent example of how edge rushers and defense, pass rushers in general, can help the quarterback. You know, in the Super Bowl, the Seattle Seahawks, you know, the quarterback, Sam Darnold, didn't do a whole lot, drove him down for field goals in the first three quarters, but he didn't have to do a whole lot because his defense held the Patriots in check, shut them out, right? On the other side, Patriots quarterback Drake May didn't really do anything, but he didn't have to do anything until later in the second half because the Patriots defense kept the Seahawks out of the end zone. But the difference was, as the game wore on into the fourth quarter, the Patriots were starting to run out of clock, and all of a sudden, Drake May did have to do stuff. He did have to press. He started making big mistakes that allowed the Seahawks to run away with it. The point is that for the first 2.5 to 3 quarters, elite defenses were able to help their quarterback by not letting the other team run away with it. And so if you get an edge rusher that's worthy of the fourth pick, it does help Cam Ward. And plus, that's a guy, especially if it's a guy that is a defensive end rushing like Reuben Bain might be, you've got a guy that's out there rushing the passer every time the quarterback drops back to pass. So, you know, these are reasons why I think that position, I am partial to it for this team if the guy that they pick is worthy of the pick.
Yeah, I feel like we're going to have these philosophical discussions a lot the next couple of months. Before we let you go, Trevor, the injunctions and the hearings and the players trying to squeeze that extra year of eligibility out to get the next payday, there's examples all across the country, not just in football. Do you think the NCAA could make a rule of an age limit across the board that would stand and just stop the madness? To me, that's probably the only way you could do it.
Yeah, well, if they made that rule, it would make sense to all of us looking at it, but it would also be challenged in court, and unless there is collective bargaining, the NCAA would lose. The NFL has an age minimum, right? Or how many years you've been out, your high school graduating class has been out of high school. And that was challenged by Maurice Claret of Ohio State, remember back in the day. And he lost that court case, but the NFL has collective bargaining. And that's the difference. So right now the NCAA, the best thing they can do is let the market work. And I kind of like the idea of what Diego Pavi was able to do, which is to say, don't count junior college against a four-year school eligibility. Joey Aguilar of Tennessee is trying to get years back for that, and Diego Pavia got it back. So the question is, will Aguilar get it back? And right now it's just a big old rip-roaring mess, but I don't see any way to impose anything from the top down that's restrictive. All you can do is remove restrictions, or else you're going to go to court and you're going to lose.
Trevor Maddich has been our guest on D-Mace, Vingan, and Donick. He joins us every Tuesday, and he is brought to you by Houston Clinic Orthopedics, when experience matters. Trevor, as always, thank you for your insight. We'll catch up next week.
Thanks, Adam.
615-737-1025. We'll take your reaction to what Trevor Maddich just had to say. But coming up next, Predators fans, I'm going to make you choose. You have to pledge your allegiance. Coming up next, 615-737-1025. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan, 1025 The Game.